listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, immigration is a political hot-button topic in the news every day. We'll talk to a reporter who's been tracking stories of people deported to their countries of origin only to be killed there. That's coming up later in the show. First, workers' compensation is an exchange between an injured worker and their employer. The employer gives up their right to sue the employee, gives up the right to sue the employer, but the employer must provide things like medical care, lost wages, or resulting disabilities. Something different happens when the employer and the injured employee don't agree about the extent or nature of an injury. An outside party may be invited in. Independent medical examiners, or IMEs for short, are hired by employers or insurance companies to make an assessment about the nature of an injury. A new report by Wisconsin Watch takes a look at criticism that these IMEs routinely side with the employer, downplaying the injury of the worker. Alexandra Hall is a Wisconsin Public Radio Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about these independent medical examiners, first of all. What is their role in a worker compensation claim?
Well, first I should say that the vast majority of workers' compensation claims don't even make it to a hearing. The latest numbers that we have are from 2016, and they show that there were about 30,000 claims that year, 5,000 were contested, and most of those reach a settlement out of court. But for the few hundred or so that do make it to court, an independent medical examiner is brought in who is hired by an self-insured employer or an insurance company to verify whether or not a worker is actually as injured as they say they are, what kind of treatment they require, and what the employer needs to pay for. And they can be brought in at different stages of the process.
But they're only going to be involved in the most contested workers' comp cases, it sounds like.
Well, actually, in one of the cases that we looked at, there was an injured worker who filed a claim and was seen by an IME pretty early on in the process. You know, they received a letter that said no additional physical therapy, treatment, pain medication is authorized through workers' comp. Any additional treatment of this condition may be your personal responsibility. And then as an afterthought, you could have a hearing before the Department of Workforce Development to contest this. And so the IME was brought in at an early stage in the process.
Can you talk about who the independent medical examiners are?
Sometimes they are doctors with active practices in the state of Wisconsin who, you know, a certain percentage of their practice is performing IMEs. They're kind of like a freelance doctor. They can also be doctors who work in other states. We found a number of names of physicians who reside outside of the state of Wisconsin came up repeatedly in our interviews with attorneys as being IMEs who often weigh in on these cases. Some of them are retired doctors. Some of them, you know, half of the time see their own regular patients in their own state and then go to other states to do IMEs.
And a judge you quote in your piece, Shavey, an administrative law judge, has seen a lot of these come through and says, basically, if I see a certain name on it, I know what this doctor is going to say. They're going to rule on behalf of that company.
I remember a couple of doctors. As soon as you see the doctor's name on a report, one knows that the opinion is going to be adverse to the injured worker. They are so blatant that it's almost a waste of time to read the report because you know what it's going to say.
Could you talk about what he had to say?
Right. Yeah. I think that Shady's perspective is really interesting because, you know, he worked as an administrative law judge focusing solely on workers' comp for 30 years. So he saw a lot of cases like this, and he's a very middle of the road kind of guy. And he talked about how some ALJs are worker applicant leaning, some are employer insurance company leaning. Even his colleagues told me that he's very middle of the road. And he said that, you know, when you look at the IME's reports and you look at the treating physicians or the injured workers' doctors' reports, you know, oftentimes these workers' comp decisions come down to what he called the battle of the dueling doctors, that doctors on both sides can be biased or advocate for the patient or the insurance company. He called it, he described it as degrees of credibility. But he said that, you know, you have to be, that's the challenge for the ALJ. They have to look at all of the facts. What did each doctor say on each case? And he said that, you know, even, you know, he felt that his antenna would go up whenever he would see an IME just as the product of his 30 years of experience. But that, you know, the majority of times the IMEs would be more leaning towards the insurance company, disproportionate to how much the treating physicians were advocating for the injured workers.
And it makes sense, at least a lot of the people you talk to, because that IME, that independent medical examiner, they're hired, as you say, by the self-insuring company or the insurance company. If they want to keep doing this and making that money, they might, if they keep ruling against or arguing against the company's not going to come back to them.
Right. And that would make sense in theory. And it's terrible that we don't have the data to actually verify that, especially because in a litigation setting, it's expected that the plaintiff side would make that argument and say, look at this IME who's coming in. They're just in the insurance company's pocket. We can't trust their diagnosis. And that's the reason why the injured worker deserves benefits. The experts that we spoke to, there's an anatomy and law professor, Sam Hodge, who we interviewed at Temple University, and said that the plaintiffs are expected to say something like that. The insurance worker, the insurance side, can say the same thing about the treating physician. But what's interesting is that while there are degrees of credibility, the treating physician is expected to provide a standard of care that the IME is not. In the state of Wisconsin and in many other states, IMEs are not considered part of a patient-doctor relationship. So that means that if a workers' comp applicant really is severely injured and an IME writes in their report or sees that they are very injured and writes in their report that they're not as injured as they observe that they are as the doctor, that examinee cannot sue the IME for medical malpractice.
And it seems like this might be what makes people uncomfortable. You'd hope that a doctor, an MD, is going to look at this injured person and try to provide as an objective assessment of a condition as you can. This feels more like an adversarial pair of lawyers who are expected to argue, you know, one side versus another side. It feels weird in medicine.
Right. And that's what I thought was really interesting about how the system is set up, especially because, you know, I and my editor talked about, well, how can we evaluate how legitimate a doctor's diagnosis is or not on one side or the other? But then we thought, well, how can a judge do that? A judge isn't a doctor either. So it's interesting that the system is set up this way. But time and again, you know, every interview that we did with attorneys, professors, judges like Judge Joe Shavey, they said, you know, this is the way that the system is set up, and we don't think that it needs to be changed because, honestly, I can't really see how else you would do it.
One, I think there's one suggestion that, like, okay, we keep the system as it is, but let's take the word independent out of the title here, because they are, in effect, hired by the company or insurance company. They're advocating, in many cases, for that side. Let's call them something other than independent.
Right. And that's something that attorneys brought up in a few interviews that we did, is that, you know, the word independent doesn't only have an effect on, you know, in a litigation setting. It also has an effect on the applicant. And IMEs don't only weigh in on workers' comp cases, but also in personal injury cases. So if a patient sees that an independent medical examiner says that, you know, they're not as ill as they think or that they don't need treatment, if you're not privy to how this system works, you might think, well, okay, you know, maybe this doctor knows more than I do. And, you know, I think that the concern on behalf of the injured workers' attorneys is that some applicants for workers' comp won't pursue their rights.
And you mentioned this briefly. Is there criticism of some patient-provided doctors that, well, they have a financial incentive, they want to get paid for providing treatment to the patient? They have an incentive to skew things in a certain way to make sure their patient gets the workers' compensation claim, thus paying them.
Absolutely. And we did hear that. I interviewed a defense attorney, recently retired, who pointed out that very detail that, you know, sometimes the treating physician will earn, you know, tens of thousands of dollars more if the workers' comp claim is taken up, is accepted as it was applied for. And the other one of the other experts that we interviewed was talking about how, you know, a treating physician is also susceptible to being impartial because, you know, when you're in medical school, you're not trained to question your patient's symptoms. You are trained to listen to your patient and do your best to fully understand what they need and treat them. So there's potential for bias on both sides.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are people talking about changing the workers' compensation system for these and other reasons? Or is it maybe a flawed system, but the best we can do?
You know, I don't know of anybody really talking about changing the system. I did hear from one attorney who said that, you know, the way that the system is set up with these IMEs and the potentials for bias has, this is the way that it's been for decades. And in fact, he talked about, he was an attorney who didn't want to be named, and he called two of the doctors in our report the Flying O'Briens. And he said when he was a young lawyer 30 years ago, there was another doctor called Zero Shapiro. And so it's kind of like, you know, there's always been doctors like this. But he said one of the things that has changed is the Labor and Industry Review Commission, the LIRC, which reviews decisions that are appealed after an administrative law judge rules on them. And he said that the difference here is that, you know, although the ALJs will see the IME report and say, we know what this means, we're aware of how the system works, the LIRC now, which is politically appointed commissioners, a board that makes decisions after they move on from the ALJ, that they are now, he believed, taking the IME reports more seriously. And he believed that's where there's room for error.
We'll leave it there. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Alexandra Hall is a fellow working for Wisconsin Public Radio and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about the most recent installment in the Broken Whistle series. First, as the debate over immigration continues on Capitol Hill, people continue to be deported back to their countries of origin. For some of these people, they may have been living in the U.S. since they were children. Our next guest looked at some of the individual stories of people who were deported despite a risk of violence and even death after their deportation. Sarah Stillman is a staff writer for The New Yorker and recently published a piece titled When Deportation is a Death Sentence. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Before we get into the stories you tell, I want to get into the why. It seems like when we talk about immigration, we're talking about numbers and statistics very often. You wanted to get into the stories behind the people who were deported and ultimately died as a result.
Exactly. So I think so often in this immigration debate, we're talking in abstractions, and I'd heard quite a lot of hypotheticals invoked on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, saying, you know, people could be deported to their deaths if we don't actually act towards immigration reform. And so part of what I set out to do with a team at Columbia Journalism School, where I teach, is really to document, you know, how often is this happening and what does it really look like on the ground for real families, especially now with increasing urgency in the debate around reforms for young people who have DACA protections.
And you tracked down the families of some people who died after being deported. I want to follow one of those stories in particular, a young woman named Laura. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Absolutely. So Laura was a mother of three children who had been living for most of her adult life undocumented in South Texas. And one night she was driving home from her restaurant job pretty late at night, and she got pulled over for a minor traffic violation, driving between two lanes. And the cop did something that was pretty unconventional at the time, but is increasingly common under President Trump, which is that he asked about her immigration status, and when he found out that she was undocumented, turned her over to Border Patrol. And all the while, Laura was absolutely pleading for her life and crying, telling both the cops and Border Patrol that she feared for her life because her ex-husband was violently threatening her with death across the border in Reynosa, Mexico. And nonetheless, she was deported the same night and was, in fact, killed the very next week by the man that she had told U.S. immigration officers would, in fact, kill her.
And so you talked to her family members, her mother, I think, in the United States, and her
exactly.
Children still in the United States.
Exactly. So she has U.S. citizen children who have struggled with a lot since their mother's deportation and death. And I also spent some time with her cousin, who had been with her the night that she was deported. Her cousin was here legally and was a recipient now of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and she'd been raised most of her life in the U.S. But now she recently has lost her status as well, because she testified in the murder trial of Laura's ex, who was convicted. She's been facing death threats and really does fear for her life down in Texas at the moment. So it's also a very urgent current story, not just what happened to Laura back in 2009.
Now, in theory, there are national and international legal protections for people who fear if they're sent back to their home country, they could die. And a lot of this, you write, stems from post-World War II, when the United States and other countries had refused to accept Jewish asylum seekers who ultimately were killed back in Germany or elsewhere in Europe. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So both domestically here in the U.S. and as an international community, it was really in the aftermath of World War II that a lot of our current refugee and asylum protections were created, to some extent as an act of repentance for what had occurred during the war itself, which entailed the U.S. government turning away a boatload in 1939 of more than 900 Jewish escapees from Nazi Germany, and then many thousands more who applied for some kind of refugee protections. Many of those people were actually sent back and killed. And so in 1951, the United Nations passed the Convention on relating to the status of refugees, which essentially said, as an international community, we are going to commit to never sending people back to a country where they may face a credible fear of being killed or being persecuted when they are sent back.
And you write that it gets a little trickier here in many of the cases, like Laura's and others. They're not being sent back to a place where necessarily the government will systematically kill people, but they're going back to places that are very dangerous and where they face personal threats, maybe from a local gang or, in Laura's case, an ex who has threatened to kill them.
Exactly. So a lot of the trouble or the complication of the fact that these protections arose out of the World War II context is that the language that was enshrined in the law really focused on protecting people who fled for reasons of their race or their religion or their nationality. And so the way the language is crafted has made it pretty complicated for people who are fleeing gang violence. So many of the people that I interviewed and many of the upwards of 60 cases that we documented as a team of people who've been deported to their deaths involved people who had fled gang violence in Central America's Northern Triangle, so the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And there it can be much more complicated to apply for asylum here in the U.S. As a result of the narrow language around protections.
Right. Talk about some of the obstacles for someone in that situation. They are here illegally, but they're trying to make the case that going back to where they're from is very likely a death sentence.
Right. Actually, people aren't always here unauthorized. Often what will happen is someone will directly present themselves at a port of entry. We've seen a massive increase in the number of cases of people from Central America who are doing that. So people who are actually declaring themselves at ports of entry to Customs and Border Protection and saying, I fear for my life if I'm sent back. And what we know before the law is that those people are supposed to be turned over to trained asylum officers and potentially get a chance to make their case before an immigration judge. And unfortunately, what my team documented and what many other research organizations and groups like the ACLU have documented is that people are being turned back before they're ever given a chance to see an immigration judge. And often they're not even being asked the required questions about whether they fear harm if sent back.
And you write that in Laura's case, now this is back during the Obama administration, she had been, you write, pressured to sign off on paperwork that says, no, I'm not under threat if I go home or back to my country of origin.
That's exactly right. So her family has actually since sued agents of Border Patrol on the grounds that they believe she was coerced into signing the paperwork. And that's also a pretty common phenomenon. There was a lawsuit settled by the ACLU in California, for instance, that involved many people from Mexico who had been coerced into signing voluntary removal paperwork. So, before the law, it was voluntary, but once examined more closely, it turns out that many of these people were pressured, sometimes even threatened with violence, other times simply not given clear information, given that they may not have spoken English or may have had other concerns around how they wound up getting deported, often pretty instantaneously. So that's another way in which our immigration system is transformed, is that many times people will not even get a chance to go before an immigration judge. And so this process can happen really quickly, in Laura's case, on the very same night.
Are there legal groups or individuals who are trying to advocate for people in this situation where, again, they may be at physical risk if they're deported?
Absolutely. So there's many groups that have been working to document this and to bring lawsuits on behalf of those who have been wronged, groups like Human Rights Watch, the ACLU, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of local legal aid groups. My story focused on an attorney in South Texas named Jennifer Harbury and her colleagues down there. So there's quite a few, and also many scholars in the region of the Northern Triangle countries, like Elizabeth Kennedy and others, who are trying to document the many harms that happen post-deportation, because often we just don't know very much about what happens after the U.S. government wrongfully sends people back.
And Sarah, how are you and your team pursuing this story now moving forward?
Well, we're really eager to follow what happens under the Trump administration, and we're looking at it not just internationally, so what happens to people post-deportation in countries like El Salvador, but also what happens domestically in terms of the public safety arguments for how many, many people who are undocumented have feared reporting gender-based crimes. So we've talked to police in departments across the country who said they've seen a decline in sexual assault reporting and domestic violence reporting from women who may fear coming forward under the Trump administration, fearful that they may face immigration repercussions for disclosing what they're experiencing. So I think that's another important chapter of this story. And certainly I'll be following closely the current DACA debate that's unfolding on the Hill and the pretty urgent stakes of that as well.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Sarah Stillman. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She joins us today to talk about the dangers some people face when they're deported from the United States. First, there are a lot of punchlines, memes, and jokes about being ignored via text or instant message. The internet loves talking about it, ranting about it, and getting advice on it. Here's a sampling from the plethora of YouTube videos on being ignored.
Can we have a moment for all of our friends who aren't texting us back?
A viewer wants to know how she can handle her friend who does not return texts or emails.
Okay, today we're going to talk about what happens if a girl, you get her phone number and then she stops answering.
So why weren't you answering any of my phone calls or my texts all week? You called me once, but I missed it. And I texted you a few times. No, you didn't. Yeah, I did.
It bothers a lot of people, from YouTubers to the cast of Dance Moms, but the whole point of lightning-fast communication seemed to be getting a hold of someone immediately. When it comes to texts and emails, that's not always the case. Research shows that one of the reasons Americans enjoy texting is because you don't have to respond immediately, like picking up that phone call, even if your phone is in your pocket most of the time. Naomi Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University and author of Words on Screen, The Fate of Reading in a Digital World. She studies how people use technology to connect. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
I'm delighted to be here.
So what is the appeal of texting for us Americans in particular in the first place?
We tend to be control freaks, and we tend to think that if we have reached out to somebody else, of course that person wants to immediately get back to us. Even though, as you just said, the technology says, I'll send this to you, a text, for example, and then you'll get back to me when it's good for you. Our problem is that we have sped up the time gap we're willing to wait before we think it's reasonable to get a response.
I want to contrast this with the old-fashioned calling someone on their landline phone. And some people, I think maybe younger people mostly, look back and say, wait a minute, you made a device in somebody's house ring when you wanted it to ring and expected them to come to the phone and talk to you right then? It was a very different sort of demand structure then.
But then we invented voicemail. And sometime around the early 80s, voicemail went commercial. It was commercial for businesses before that, but it became something you could have in your own home. So if you didn't want to answer a call and it came in over dinner, it would just go to your answering machine. And we got used to saying we can decide whether we want to pick up that phone or not. When telephones were first invented, the assumption is if that telephone rang, because they were very expensive in those days, some emergency was going on and you had to pick up the phone because somebody died. They probably weren't going to say you won the lottery. There were no lotteries. But the notion of how soon you had, whether you had to respond. At first, it was everybody had to. Then we said, okay, we can control things a little bit, put it on the answering machine. But with the newest technologies, we have assumed, because the message goes really fast, that we should respond really fast if we care.
And now we're in this situation, it seems like, and I've read a lot of people talk about this, that in addition to the message itself, right, I text you, you text me back or not, or in a certain period of time, I'm reading a lot of message in how quickly you respond, not just in the words you respond with.
Correct. And part of the problem is people actually are sometimes driving vehicles, or they're on planes where they don't happen to have an internet access, or heaven help us, they're sitting in my classroom, and I would really prefer they not respond right now. But what has happened, particularly for teenagers and young adults, I mean, there's more to the story, but particularly for those age groups, there's a lot of insecurity. If I don't respond immediately, maybe that's sending you a message, as it were, that I don't care about you. But if you have invited me to come to lunch or to go to the movies tonight and I don't get right back to you, you may move on to somebody else because I didn't care about you, right? So we have ratcheted up the expectation structure. We've ratcheted up the anxiety structure. And we didn't really need to do this. When email first came along, it was very slow, depending on what kinds of service you had and whatever. Sometimes it could take a week to get a message out. It was sort of like sending something through the U.S. Postal Service. But then as it became faster and faster, our expectation structure sped up as well. And it's problematic because we shouldn't, but there's so little that we really have to respond to immediately because there's some emergency. We've turned our lives, our daily lives, into emergencies.
We're talking to Naomi Barron from American University, author of the book Words on Screen. We're talking about why and when it's acceptable to not reply to a text or email or other communication quickly or at all. Naomi, it seems like etiquette rules develop slowly and our communication systems are developing quickly and one never catches up with the other. Is that part of the problem, that we don't have enough time with one method of communication to figure out how we're supposed to do it?
The question is, what counts as etiquette these days? The days of Emily Post are gone. What counts as etiquette? Well, back in the day of email, you would lurk, you would see what other people did, and you'd say, oh, that's what you're supposed to do when sending an email. With instant messaging, it became, who are you, you know, what's your circle of friends, how did they behave, how quickly do they respond, and so forth, because instant messaging is not always instant. By the way, I did some studies on that to show you may wait and say, well, what do I want to say, and do I want to edit this before I send it out? Do I want to show this to a friend, my potential response, before I send it? But what's happened now is there is no shared consensus. Remember, nobody governs the internet in a very profound way. And the same thing is true for so-called rules for how you respond. The rules basically are what your friends do, rather than there being some larger social consensus about what's appropriate. And that's the challenge.
One tricky thing is how much communication there is. Just thinking about not even my personal life here, just in my business life, I get a lot of emails. There's Slack for some purposes. There's texting for some other purposes. A little bit of social media messaging in there, too. It seems like we're living in a constant sense of triage of what we need to deal with right now.
That is true. It is also, at least for the personal messages, much more an American phenomenon than it is something that happens worldwide. We somehow think that whatever we do in the United States, any smart person anywhere on the globe would do. But when you check the numbers of how many texts Americans send per day and compare that with other countries, I'm thinking particularly of statistics for Western Europe, they're a lot more stable than we tend to be, in that there isn't so much a rush. You don't have to keep going back and forth with volleys all the time. You send what you want to send, and then you move on. You have a life. You go to a restaurant. You actually talk with your friends. You put your phone away.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you assign value judgments to how we're dealing with our communication here. It sounds like you do a little bit. Where do you see us going wrong?
Well, if I assign a value judgment, it's because I worry about our psyches. And our psyches have come to say, and some of this is particularly American, that I always have to show how wonderful I am. So you take Facebook, and various people have done studies on Facebook, myself included, and I wrote a chapter of a book a couple books ago called My Best Day, because when I interviewed people about what they put on Facebook, what they put for a photograph, because it used to be you could only put one photograph, a young woman said to me, I put a picture of me on my best day, when I really look good. That's not how I usually look. But I present myself in the way that the sociologist Irving Goffman used to talk about presentation of self. I present myself so people will think I look really good. There's a lot of discussion of Facebook right now on how the more you use Facebook, the more depressed you tend to be, the more lonely you tend to be, because everybody else is having such a wonderful time. Look at all those photographs. Look at all those status updates. And you feel, what's wrong with me? I'm not vacationing enough. I don't look good enough. So we have boxed ourselves into a communication corner, both in terms of I always have to respond, and in terms of how we make ourselves look on our social networks. And it's not psychologically healthy for us. It's not a value judgment on my part. The psychologists will tell you the same thing.
Naomi Barron is with us, professor of linguistics at American University, author of the book Words on Screen, The Fate of Reading in a Digital World. We're looking at how we communicate and ignore each other through texting, instant messaging, and other technology. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you been on either side of this argument? Why didn't you get back to me? Why didn't you respond to my text, my email, my Facebook message, whatever? Do you think we are too quick to respond, too quick to expect other people to respond? Does it bother you when people don't get back to you from that text or email? Or whatever you're using. What expectations or rules do you set for yourself or others when it comes to messaging? And are we just sending too darn many texts, emails, etc.? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Naomi Barron, professor of linguistics at American University. We're looking at texting and email and when we choose not to respond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about texting, emailing, instant messaging? Do you feel like we're using it too much, like you're having to use it too much? Do you feel like there are different expectations between you and others about when you get back to each other? How quickly? Does it bug you when people don't get back? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Melissa is with us in Peshtigo. Melissa, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think every now and then you need to put the phone away, take a break from it, and I think that on the weekends, put your phone away, charge it, and leave it on the counter, leave it in your purse. And you don't need it glued to your hand all the time. You need that mental break to rejuvenate, regenerate, be ready for work on Monday morning. And if you constantly have your phone in your hand and are worrying about responding and getting hold of people and Facebooking and Instagramming and Snapchatting, you don't get the mental break that you need to really just be ready to go back to work and face everything on Mondays.
Is this something you're doing yourself on the weekends, Melissa?
Yeah, I do. And it's interesting the comments you get back from people asking, where are you? Why didn't you answer my text? Or what are you doing? And I'm like, well, why didn't you call me? I would answer a call before I would answer a text.
Melissa, thank you so much for your call, and I'm glad we answered it. Naomi, there's a lot there. What do you think of her put the phone away and recharge idea, first of all?
I love it. And actually, there are a number of schools, both high schools and colleges, or classes within colleges, that are saying, we're going to take a week where you're not going to use your phone, and you will survive. You will live to tell the tale. And people write articles on after interviewing the students who have done this, and they tell you they're very anxious for the first couple of hours or maybe the first day. And after that, they start talking with each other, and they start relaxing and feeling much better about themselves. So I think it's an excellent plan. We need as a society to do it. I also think about what I saw when I was in Japan this past October. Literally in Tokyo, there are painted signs on the street saying no use of cell phones. And partly that's because people are bumping into each other and getting hit by traffic because they're using their phones for the equivalent of texting. But partially it's because in Japan there's a social etiquette that says when you're moving in public space, you should be with other people. Even if you don't know them, you're still part of a society. So there are some places, both here in the States and in Japan, that are trying to do something, and we need to do more of this.
Melissa, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Robert on the line in Onalaska. Robert, hi.
Hi, how you doing there? And hi to your guest. I just wanted to talk about, I think that there is actually too much email, phone traffic going on. So what I like to do is, when it comes to my personal family members, I make sure that they don't do anything like send me an email or anything like that. They have to automatically send me a message, a voicemail message. Otherwise, it's not important. When it comes to texting, I don't accept texting from my personal family members because I want them to actually call me. And that's how, what I have to do to in order to control the traffic. And I don't even have Facebook. And I do that on purpose so that they can actually interact with me and, you know, just to make sure that they actually talk to me.
Robert, thank you so much. So both of our callers, Naomi, making a case for calling, but it seems like more and more we're allergic to making that phone call.
We're allergic for a couple of reasons, and businesses and organizations are also getting allergic. If you have a son or daughter who's in college and you try calling that son or daughter and the call goes to voicemail, the son or daughter calls back and says, "Hi, Mom," or "Hi, Dad, what's up?" And you say, "Did you get my voicemail?" And they say, "Well, just tell me what's up." We do not listen to voicemail anymore. My university has now taken away, for anybody who wants to take it away, voicemail. So it's written communication, in this case email, or if they're not in their office when I call, I can't reach them. A number of large businesses, including Coca-Cola and a number of telecommunications businesses and a number of banks, have said, we don't want to clog your life with email, with voicemail, because it takes too long to listen.
True.
Therefore, the only way to communicate is in writing. And I find that to be problematic, because there's some things where a voice is actually a very useful way to go. It is true, it takes much longer to listen to the same number of words than it does to read them. But I am not a typist. I'm a human. I mean, typists are human beings, but my life is not, should not be spent totally in typing. I should spend it talking with people face to face. The next best thing is on some kind of a telephone, whether it's voice over internet protocol or whether it's a real telephone. But I like your caller's approach. Mm. Because there's so much more in their communication that we can express in speaking that doesn't quite come across when you make me type all the time.
Naomi, I'm all for the human voice, given my job. Thank you so much for spending this time today. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. I've enjoyed this.
Naomi Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University. She's the author of the book Words on Screen, The Fate of Reading in a Digital World. She joined us to look at how we communicate and sometimes ignore each other through instantaneous communication like texting, social media, email, and more. You can share your thoughts and experiences. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The state Senate is scheduled to vote tomorrow on the confirmations of Brian Bell and Michael Haass, the leaders of Wisconsin's Ethics and Elections Commissions. If the vote goes as planned for majority Republicans, both men will soon be fired. They're being targeted for their roles at an agency Republicans disbanded after it investigated Governor Scott Walker. Sean Johnson reports.
Chances are most people don't know Brian Bell or Mike Haass. They're administrators, not elected officials, who were only recently thrust into the spotlight. When it became clear the Senate would soon give them up or down votes without first giving them public hearings, they decided to fight for their jobs. Haass has granted interviews where he's talked about his support from the bipartisan Elections Commission.
I answer to our commission. Our commission's made up of three Republicans, three Democrats. They've unanimously supported me. They unanimously appointed me.
Bell's commission is split the same way and has supported him, too. He's gone so far as requesting an investigation of himself to prove that he's not partisan.
I believe, with all my heart, that an objective review of my conduct in service to this state would definitively show that I have consistently conducted myself in a nonpartisan and impartial manner.
The reason Bell and Haas could lose their jobs is that they both worked for the Government Accountability Board. Republicans disbanded the GAB in 2015, largely because of its role in an investigation called a John Doe. This one looked at conservative groups and Governor Scott Walker's campaign. That probe resurfaced because there was an investigation of the investigation. Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel issued an 87-page report on who leaked information about the Doe, which is supposed to be secret.
We want to do whatever we can to try to guarantee for the targets of all these search warrants that their stuff isn't still out there somewhere.
Schimmel's report was sharply critical of the GAB, saying the agency's attorneys, quote, were on a mission to bring down the Walker campaign and the governor himself, and that they'd prejudged the guilt of the governor. That passage wasn't referring to Bell or Haas, but rather a statement from former Government Accountability Board attorney Shane Falk. He's now a lawyer in private practice.
The whole report, as far as I'm concerned, was replete with a bunch of speculative conclusions, essentially to feed the monster, which is this objection to the Government Accountability Board investigating truly illegal conduct.
Falk concedes he made unprofessional statements in emails. In one, he accuses a special prosecutor of lying. In another, he refers to the bastardization of politics, saying the state is being run by corporations and billionaires. But Falk says there was nothing misguided about the John Doe investigation, since Wisconsin courts had held for 15 years that coordination between third-party groups and campaigns was illegal.
If anything, I was a zealous advocate for what the law was.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled otherwise, shutting down the Walker John Doe. The entire affair had faded into the background until it resurfaced with Schimmel's report. Forced to defend himself, Haas, who is a top elections official at the GAB, is defending his former agency.
Nobody can point to any decision or action of myself or the GAB or the current elections commission that's been based on partisan motives.
Meanwhile, Bell is distancing himself from the GAB, where he worked for 3 years. He sent a letter to senators criticizing Falk as a partisan and calling the Government Accountability Board biased. If the Senate votes to fire Bell and Haas, this saga may not be over. Some of their supporters have hinted that they might sue on the grounds that only the Ethics and Elections Commissions can fire their administrators. Those bipartisan boards support Bell and Haas unanimously and don't want to find new leaders, especially in what promises to be a busy election year. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.